This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network in Latin American Studies, a podcast in the New Books Network. I am Kenneth Sanchez, one of the hosts of the channel. And today I will be talking with Lorena Cuya Gavilano about her interesting new book, Fictions of Migration, Narratives of Displacement in Peru and Bolivia. This book analyzes and explores the effects and epistemologies of migration in Peru and Bolivia through cultural production such as films, novels, and short stories in the context of regional neoliberal rearrangements. Dr. Cuya Gavilano is an assistant professor of Latin American cultures at Arizona State University. Her areas of specialization are migration studies, film analysis, contemporary Latin American cultural studies, and human geography. Thank you for joining us here today, Lorena.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.
Perfect. Perhaps to begin, you can tell us a little bit about yourself and the path that led you to write this book.
Yeah, well, I'm Peruvian, and I'm from Lima, but my family is, my grandfamily, my mother's family comes from the north of Peru, and part of my dad's family come from the south of Peru, and also from Cajamarca in the north, in the Andes. So I think that just listening to their experiences and stories of adaptation and work in the coast, specifically in Lima, has also like raised up curiosity, a lot of questions, and it has shaped my life, right? So it's like many people in the capital. So I think that had a great influence in the why I'm interested in migration. And then for my PhD, I traveled to the US, and then I became a different kind of migrant. So that also raised another set of questions for me, and about adaptation and cultural perception, and how the dynamics and the economics influence different cultural perspectives. So that is more or less like my path. It's personal in many ways.
Yes, of course. And before we go on about this book, I think it will be useful for our listeners to know a little bit more about the historical background of your book, to locate it in time to place it within a frame. Perhaps you can tell us briefly about the historical background, both of Peru and Bolivia.
Well, we share something that is interesting is like we used to be part of the same country, and then for historical reasons, we took our own paths, right? But in terms of like the ethnic constitution of each country, I think we're similar, except for our attitudes toward these different ethnicities is different. And the book deals with this from the 1970s until the first decade of the 21st century. So I talk about books such as Los Zorros by Arguedas, and also books as recent as Abril Rojo or Lost City Radio by Daniel Alarcón. And the reason why I chose this is because we can see a change from the in the 70s when Arguedas was writing. Like we've seen like the second waves of migration towards the capital and all the changes that came with modernization, and then all the changes that came after all the more recent waves of migration after the war against Sendero Luminoso, the Shiny Path. And in the case of Bolivia, also the words I select for the book were produced after the 1950s, when you have the revolution in Bolivia. So I think that, and also the modernization processes, industrialization, and that brought a new set of challenges for both societies and a lot of migration towards the cities. And that is something that it's similar, right? Like during the 50s and 60s, we have a new modernization processes throughout Latin America. And these two countries share these similar patterns in particular, but with different reactions toward the people who were migrating to the cities. And so that it's a little bit of the context for these two countries. But also I have to say, like in Peru, one of the differences between Peru and Bolivia is that we had the Fujimori dictatorship, right? And with Fujimori, we have like the official entrance in the neoliberal economy and neoliberal market that was welcomed by many Peruvians. And I think that we can see the consequences of that to this day when we see many people, I think, on the right side of the economic ideologies in Peru, right? Like all about free markets and the deregularization. Whilst in Bolivia, I think people have witnessed this uprising, right? Like the waking of indigenous populations and indigenous movements, a lot of protests against the privatization of water, of gas, of oil, etc. So the reaction of the people has been different towards this neoliberal economies and dynamics. And in the case of Bolivia, for example, instead of moving towards the right, as is the case of Peru, they have moved towards more decolonial approach to politics and ways of living and recognizing the indigenous background and the people in indigenous communities taking power too. We can see that with Evo Morales, and even now, like again, with the new Bolivian president, Luis Arce, right? So there is all these different reactions in these two countries toward in the face of neoliberal policies. And that is what I think has shaped in many ways the different visions of the migrants in these two countries. That's a little bit of the background.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's very important. And that's very well put. I want to talk to you a bit about your framework or the way you read these cultural productions, such as films and novels. I'm really interested in knowing a little bit more about the effective epistemology that you use, the decolonial reading of these productions to serve the purpose of reaching these or analyzing these fictions of migration, of these migrational fictions, as you call them.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is that my point of departure is that in our society today, we're so used to value recent science in like STEM fields, for example, the STEM career paths as opposed to humanities. So it's all this the privilege of reason and practical thinking, utilitarianism in a way. And we have to a certain degree left aside like emotions and feelings and discard them as something that it's subjective and of no value, that we cannot learn anything from it. And today, I think there is a little bit of a change of turn back to paying attention to the emotions and to the sense of community that, at least in the Indian countries, and I know in that South Africa too, right? So this, this affective epistemology is like we can learn through feelings, through emotions, we can learn from them. And in the case of the works that I select for this book, the character's goal is not that they are learning from reading books or from watching the news or listening to, I don't know, podcasts or the radio or I don't know, or it's not that, it's that it's their own personal experience, their own feelings that leads them to recover certain the value of their communities, of their traditions, and what they have forgotten by moving towards modernity, which equates in this case to moving towards the cities where the new industries are, where the new opportunities are, where the new markets are. So in that sense, that these paying attention and underscoring the feelings of the characters, migrant characters in particular, their hardships and emotions, it's it is important for them to open up another set of questions where they can end up recovering their cultural roots. So that is, and this is something that with the car, for example, it's all about the reason, right? We cannot believe in anything that cannot be proven, or with positivism, for example, we need a physical proof of something. We need, to see something, to believe, etc. And this is another way to see it. It's not a scientific method. It's emotions. It's pure emotions. And I think that is important. It's something that we do not pay attention much. But it's something that I think, especially with the new indigenous movements in a different in Indian countries like Ecuador, Bolivia, and now Peru, we are in a way kind of recovering that. It's like a different kind of knowledge. And in that sense, it is decolonial. It is like it goes against the our Western view of what reason is, what knowledge is valuable, which one is not.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. That's why I really wanted to know a bit more about that from yourself. And now moving on to the book itself, I wanted to ask you first about the first chapter. It's called "Anxiety for the Future: Migration in Peruvian Cinema." I was very interested in your decision to choose two Chasqui films, Gregorio and Juliana from 85 and 88, and two more recent films, Claudia Llosa's Maidenusa and La Teta Asustada, or The Milk of Sorrow in English. And I was really interested in the decision to choose these films to tell the story of migrational fictions, as you say, but also the change, the way you analyze it, the change between how we portray migration, and also the view of who makes cinema, how we make cinema to portray this fiction. Perhaps you can tell us a bit more about this chapter and about this change and who was in charge of perhaps portraying these migrational fictions.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Well, with the Chasqui movies were produced in a different period with a different cinema law in Peru in the 80s, and Claudia Llosa clearly obviously belonged to neoliberal period when the cinema law changed and there was less help to filmmakers. It's not that today there's our cinema is still working on so many different things, especially funding, but before Fujimori, the cinema industry had a little bit of help and with national topics of interest, And that changed after the cinema law. There was no funding to create shorts or long films about any national issue. And by national issue, I mean like topics such as agriculture or race and ethnicity, class difference, and things like that that we need to really face and question, because we tend to ignore these problems even though they are in our face. I think these films try to problematize that and try to bring to the fore these migrant characters, in the Chesky case, children who are migrant or children of migrants who end up living alone. They run away from their houses and try to create different communities with other children and kind of create a different, an alternative way of living in a poor community, but still it works differently. It's more about solidarity and how they're gonna not only survive, but create a community that can, where they can support each other emotionally too, not just surviving physically. In the case of Josa, she had a different form of production. She was educated in Peru and then in Europe, and she got funding from private institutions, and she even created her own production company to sponsor her own films. And it's like, just thinking about that, she has all these opportunities of privilege and class that allows her to produce a different kind of film that was released first in Europe, not in Peru, for example, as opposed to Chesky. But with this kind of external aid, this transnational funding, she also had different, how can I say this? Like, she needed to show also certain images. It compromised the production, and she, in a way, has to show in sometimes the very stereotypical images of migrants, of Andean migrants in particular, where they are not educated, where they are dirty, where they are, they need to be helped. It's a very paternalistic view, I would say, of the migrant there. I mean, it is in a way, it's nice that somebody's showing that. It's nice that somebody is showing the aftermath of the war in the case of La Teta Asustada, for example. But there is also this other side where we are seeing a woman who has this irrational fear that goes against Western medicine, and that has very weird behavior, sleeping with the dead corpse of corpse of the mother, for example, in The Milk of Sorrow. So that, in a way, is portraying the migrant as a deranged person, and that is even more striking, for example, in Marainusa, where you have a completely alienated person, and you actually, only the last scene is the scene of a real migration, because the whole movie is about like forming this idea of this character who wants to escape, who wants to leave the town to go towards modernity, a person who's worshiping Barbie dolls or Barbie dolls images and plastic earrings and things like that, that come from supposedly the capital, modernity. And so she goes to extreme measures to get to the capital, meets this guy who's coming, Salvador, who's coming from Lima, and she asks him to take her to the capital, right? Cries and have sex with him, and then ask him to run away, right? So that's one thing that she's using this character. And the other part, besides this betrayal, is that it's also an incestuous community. So Andean communities are like drunkards and an incestuous, and nobody, it seems in this in Madainusa, that nobody cares about that. It's absolutely normal to have a relationship with your daughter, right? No, nobody protests that. That is normalized in the film, in a way. And I think that all these details help to form an idea of a migrant. The person who is going to arrive to the capital is again, in a way, a little bit of a psychopath, right? Like she's poisoning her father, betraying the poor Lemanian guy who's trying to save her. And she's incestuous and she doesn't question that. She just wants to go to the city. That's all she wants, right? So, but she has no other questioning of reality or of the city, or like it's just that this obsession that is unjustified in the movie, and I think that could be problematic. And again, it is important to have movies that talk about the isolation of Andean communities and how we have abandoned, how many people don't have the same opportunities that are offering the capital. But the way that it is presented, it's troubling. And I can mention, like, for example, like Oscar Catacora, Uña y Pacha, right? It's more recent, and it's also about the an abandoned community, but the portrayal, it's not about like just exhibiting how these weird Andean communities behave, right? It's not about that in a way morbid. It's a closer approach. It's a more effective, right? It's about the consequences. It makes us think about like, oh my gosh, what happened with this community when somebody leaves, although we don't see the migrant there, right? So that is, I think that makes a big difference. The approach, even like with the camera, like the angles of the camera, like Joseph tends to have these very vertical shots that show the migrant like small. Well, for example, Catacora has this more close-ups, it's more like intimate vision of these Andean communities represented by the only two protagonists in the case of Catacora's film. So by the time I was writing the book, I obviously Catacora's film wasn't out, so I would have chosen that too for the book. But because there are different visions of the migrant, and I think like because Joseph's movie was financed externally, she had certain set of commitments and expectations she needed to fit to, you know, show what is this Peruvian thing with color and things like that. So I think that could be problematic. I think it has a lot of merit, like this, her films have merits, but at the same time, I point out the troubling depictions of migrants. But something that it's interesting, though, is that in spite of these problematic images, she's still appealing to this emotional side of the migrants, which people do not normally pay attention to, right? Like, it's all about like, oh, they're thieves in Lima, and or they are the background in other films about violence or comedies. So they're just the background, right? So it's like this, I think it's important because she, in spite of all the issues that I have mentioned, it's still bringing attention to an important issue, right? And it's bringing attention from an emotional perspective.
Yes, and not to continue going on about, I thought it was a good selection of films that you had here to talk about migrational fictions. And just to mention Uña y Pacha and also the new film Mango Capac. Mango Capac obviously tells the story of an internal migration, and so Uña y Pacha does it differently. But there's the empathy in the camera and the way these topics are handled. It shows you the difference in empathy and seeing themselves a bit more part of the community that being someone who's maybe extracting something or looking from an outside place, outside looking in. And I think that's very interesting. I thought it was really good how you analyzed those topics on when you were referring about Glaleyoso's work, which obviously are very good. I don't want to take anything away from her cinema, which is obviously, is just a different approach to perhaps these topics, you know, in the sense of the treatment of people and the way you position them as well. But more recent, the Lima-based films that just put indigenous populations on the background of films instead of position them as active participants or even as participants in the movie. But that's just as a comment on the films. And there's so much more we could talk about the Peruvian cinema and how it relates to migrational fictions. Because as you mentioned, there's a lot, and your selection was quite good to give a broad stroke of what goes on in there. But just to keep ourselves within the podcast and going on to chapter two. Chapter two is called On the Edge, Peruvian Narratives of Migration. And now you look at novels or short stories, and you examine four, which is José María Arguedas, El Zorro de Arriba, El Zorro de Abajo, Cromo el Jaras, Montacerdos, which are from 71 and 81, and some more recent examples of narratives, which is Santiago Rongagliolo's Abril Rojo from 2006 and Daniel Alarcón's Lost City Radio from 2007. I was very interested in this selection, because it's quite a broad selection that gives us quite a complete picture of works that look at how migrants are represented in fiction novels. But I was quite curious about the inclusion of Daniel Alarcón. What was your decision there with these four books, and especially the inclusion of Alarcón's Los City Radio, which is a great book, but I thought it was quite a different inclusion. Again, Santiago Rangaglos as well, but Daniel Alarcón stood out to me a bit more.
Yeah, well, if you see, this is an excellent question. If you take Zorros and Montacerdos, no, El Zorro de Arriba, El Zorro de Abajo, Montacerdos, you have two authors who are internal migrants in Peru and who are writing about their the condition of the mestizo and the condition of Indian people in different cities. In the case of the Zorros, is in Chimbote. In the case of Montacerdos, is in Lima, in the outskirts of Lima. So they represent the 20th century. And then we have this other different, and it's like the idea behind my decision was a little bit like follow a path in the ways that migrants have been represented, internal migrants in particular, and also from authors who were internal migrants and that had issues within different cities. Right, they explore the differences even among migrants in these cities, because it's Afro-Peruvian migrants, indigenous migrants, mestizo migrants, or Cholo migrants in the city of Chimbote, how they have their differences and disputes in that city, right? So it's a different microcosm, and then Montacerdo is also another. Let's say a universe, right, where new migrants are not welcome even in a shanty town that has been legally scripted in the city. So they represent a different period, a different kind of vision about the migrant. And then the other two novels, which are were published in the first decade of the 21st century. Written by authors who are transnational. So that's a different, but these authors have maintained this connection. They're not only immigrants, right? They also keep their connection with Peru. They're transnational. They work in the case of Roncagliolo in Spain, in Mexico, and Lima. And then in the case of Alarcón, he's working from the U.S., but he is talking about, even though he doesn't mention the word Peru explicitly, right? But he has done that in different interviews. He's inspired by what he has seen and researched in Peru. His narrative, like not only in Abril Rojo, but in A War by the Candlelight and City of Clowns, is like, it's about Peru and migration and the class difference and ethnic differences as well. And so why Alarcón? I think he's a Peruvian American writer, right? So he's still Peruvian. And I think it's important to put in the map how the transnational production of literature in Peru / US is still talking about these topics, and what is the view of these Peruvian writers who are also immigrants, external immigrants, and how the actually how the very fact that they are outside the country has shaped their vision of internal migrants in Peru. How paying attention to this issue is in a way keeping their connection with the country alive, right? With their homeland alive. And I think it's really important to pin in a map these other authors who are writing from somewhere else, but are also still dealing with very important Peruvian issues that other people were not paying attention to before them, except for Arguedas or Montacertos. And we have talked a lot about indigenism and literature as indigenism or urban literature in the 50s, for example. But we have forgotten what the very process that has led us from indigenous literature towards urban literature, which is migration. So I my intention was to map that by choosing different authors from different periods to kind of trace of how it has changed and how why like the interest about migrants can also be inspired by the very fact that we have authors who live abroad and are thinking about this because they have family who have migrated, because they have been, they themselves are migrants, right? So it's like, how does that really affect their vision and how do they expect in a way that this production, in a way, like keeps their ties with the country tight? And not only that, but there is another factor, which is the economic factor of publishing abroad and how much attention they can get. We know Arguedas gets attention because, well, he's awesome. But, for example, Cron Guajara is not as well known as Arguedas or as Roncagliolo or Alarcón, who have been publishing from abroad, right, and have received a lot of attention because they are these transnational authors who are publishing with these, big publishing houses in the U.S. and in Spain. So that also has a different impact and give them more, a louder voice, if you wish, like a louder voice to talk about these important issues. So I just wanted to pin that in the map of the literary map of Peruvian narratives.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, definitely. I think that was very interesting and made me understand a bit more the intentions behind that selection. And going now to the third chapter, you did the same thing, but for Bolivian cinema and for Bolivian novels and short stories in chapter three called Affective Epistems, Bolivian Cinema of Migration. It's always interesting to read about films that I haven't seen and especially cinema from a country I haven't heard that much about. You look at Paolo Agassi's 1982's Mi Socio, Jorge Sanjines' 1989's La Nación Clandestina, Juan Carlos Valdivia's 2005 American Visa, and his 2013 movie Ibi Marae. I was quite interested in the difference between these films and the previous films you mentioned before, the way they portray migration and the migrants themselves. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, well, I the same as in the chapter about Peruvian cinema, I wanted to give the vision of and the trajectory of depictions of migrants in the second half of the 20th century, and then how has changed in the 21st century. And also it's complicated because Agassi, for example, he has been nationalized, he became a citizen, a Bolivian citizen, but he's originally from Italy. But I interviewed him, and he has always been, according to him, a Bolivian in his heart. And he has worked with the people of Grupo Camao, which they were like a film collective that produced cinema about indigenous issues. But their intention was to work with them, not to tell stories about them, but to make people in different indigenous communities the protagonists of their stories, like actors. And they had some say in the writing of the scripts of the movies. So that's a different kind of cinema, having something in script and talking about the migrant or talking about the indigenous person. But it's the indigenous person, it's indigenous people's communities are participating in the filmmaking process. So this is the Ucamau project in brief. And Agassi traveled to Bolivia to work with them specifically, and he fell in love with the project, and he has been living in Bolivia ever since. And so when he filmed Mi Socio, which is a comedy, but also a drama in a little bit. He has these two characters who I think in a way they're like doing what he did and what he has seen people doing in Bolivia, just going back through the provinces in Bolivia and getting to renew their traditions and revalue that. So it's like the process of migration in his film. It's interesting because it allows that it's kind of a road movie. The trip of these two characters, who it's a truck driver and a kid who decides to be the helper, it really goes and engage into different communities and engage with them, help them, and also problematize that with the main adult character being a womanizer, and the kid trying to form his own vision of how he wants to be and what is his hope. They come from opposite parts of the country, one from the Andes, the other from the more like the valleys, the Amazonian area, and they represent this different vision. The what in Bolivia they call Coyas, which are more Andean, and then Cambas is new. Cambas would be like the equivalent for I don't know what we call Chunchos or people from the Amazonian area region. That would be that difference. And he put those different perspectives together, and how, despite this different perspective, they are seeing the same values in the country while they're traveling. So it's a trip, a learning trip, kind of a building trauma for these two characters in a way. So then Valdivia's movie, San Jimenez, it's an iconic movie. Like that, you cannot write about migration without talking about San Jimenez, and his important work leading the group Ucamau, and obviously La Nación Clandestina is, I think, one of his, if not the most well-known, famous movie, one of the most famous, directed by him. And in that movie, he actually represents it's a migrant character. It comes from a Aymara community and goes to the city. And the movie basically shows the process in which the character realizes that he, as an indigenous person, will never really be accepted by society. And he decides to go back to through his IU to his community. And then he rediscovers the values of his community, trying to reunify with them, to work for them, with them, and to die for it in a ritual dance. And what is important about this movie is that it shows the colonial process, like, through the migrant. And the migrant is doing that by, like, all his travel, all his steps towards the city and going back to his community are exactly that. It's like discovering, like, how our minds are being, like, we are absorbed by Western values and forget our indigenous part. And then going back, how can we recover that and value it in spite of shame? And that is very important, because it's like he wants to look more westernized, dressing differently, abandoning his traditional clothing, abandoning his own name. The main character, it's called, his last name is Mamani, but then when he goes to the city, he doesn't want to be Mamani, so he changed it to Meisman, like a Germany last name, and he's evidently indigenous, but he doesn't want to be seen as indigenous. He denies that in so many different ways. And then when he realizes that he will never be accepted, in spite of, like, he changing dressing, he changes jobs, or he changing his last name, he goes back. Well, there are a lot of factors too in the movie, but he goes back and he starts to accept his identity and recovers the traditions. And actually he decides to sacrifice himself as a way to get back to the community. So he starts doing this, the Hacha Tanta Danzante, in which it's basically like he dances with a mask and till he dies. And in that way, he could be reincorporated in the IU, in the community. So he decides to do that because he doesn't see that how else he can save his soul in a way, but he has to go back to the earth, to Mother Earth. And so he dies doing this, performing this traditional dance that was even forgotten within his own community. So he's trying to, you know, like, pay tribute to that. And that is very important. Those are very iconic. I mean, the Gassi's movie and San Ginés movie are iconic movies to watch. And then in the 21st century, Juan Carlos Valdivia, like, I think that some people see him a little bit like Claudia Llosa, but I think he's different. And when I interviewed him too, like, he actually claims that he follows the path of San Ginés by, for example, in his film Ibe Marai, he worked with a Guarani migrant in the city, and they both grow the Eli Ortiz is his name. They both wrote the script for the movie. So and it's this trip that the filmmaker, played by the Valdivia himself, and Eli Ortiz take. They have a road trip, and they again go inside a Guarani communities in Bolivia. It's a beautiful film. Visually, it's beautiful, and also the very fact that, like San Ginés, he decides to do the movie with not professional actors, and he co-writes this with the characters. So that is interesting, and I think not many people knew that about his film. I think that makes a big difference. And he is not looking at the migrants; he's working with them, right? And basically depicting his own story and relationship with them, and questioning not the indigenous way of life, but questioning his own whiteness and how people see this mestizo, white mestizo from the city, from La Paz. So that's a very important movie. And it's a movie that celebrates in many ways, the advent of these new indigenous movements and reinvention of traditions and retaking control of forms of government and economics in Bolivia. And Bolivia is very aware of that. He, when I interviewed him, he told me he was in Mexico, in the US and then in Mexico. And he decided to go back to Bolivia because he saw that there, with all the uprisings, right, before Evo Morales and all the movements and economic and political changes that led to Evo Morales taking power and changing the constitution, etc. He saw these changes as a very important moment. And he decided to go back to his country and to contribute to that change. And one of his contributions is the making of his films, especially Ive Marai, which is a celebration of indigeneity and community and recovery of values and questioning the power of white people in a colonial society. He is basically questioning himself, judging the white population in Bolivia, as opposed to just, I don't know, like showing the way Guarani communities live. It's just, it's not about that. It's about how Guarani communities can question him and can make him, help him question also his identity and his links to different cultures in his country. His other movie, it's also about migration, but it's, again, it's a character who has already migrated, and then it's a kid who has migrated, and then the father wants to follow him and reunite with his son in the U.S. But he's confronted with the main character is a teacher, and then the other character is a prostitute. And they start basically questioning the American dream versus the Bolivian dream, and what does that mean in a country like Bolivia, right? So I think like that premise led me to choose this film because it's basically questioning the whole cultural revolution, if you wish, in Bolivia. What does it mean to be Bolivian? What does the Bolivian dream entail? And in this case, it's not just going somewhere else. It's staying home and valuing the cultures that you already have, the things that you're facing, no matter what. So it's, I think I wanted to see a pattern of development before Evo, after the revolution of the 1950s in Bolivia. And I think these movies represent that path, a slow march towards the colonial way of thinking that is very strong in Bolivia.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoy that chapter, and also Jorge Sanjines' La Nación Clandestina. At least the first bit reminded me a bit of about Ribeiro's Alienación, a bit. Not sure if that.
Yeah.
One. Yeah, just a bit at the beginning, especially going on to the fourth chapter, which is alternative communities, Bolivian narratives of migration. You look at Jesús Urzagasti's Los Tejedores de la Noche from 1996, El Jardín de Nora by Blanca Wietkuter from 1998. Yeah. Cuando Sara Chura Despierte from Juan Pablo Piñeiro from 2003, and El Blues del Minibus by Antoine Rodriguez Carmona from 2015. I thought it was very interesting, especially, again, put it in counterpoint with the Peruvian's narratives of migration and the difference between, you can see the difference as well in Peruvian and Bolivian cinema and their narratives of migration as you have laid it out. It focuses on the migrants as subjects of knowledge, and that's very interesting in how they position themselves and how they physically they celebrate their identity. They position that front, right, and center. Perhaps you can tell us a bit more about these books and how migrants recognize themselves and their identity, and it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, in these books, which all of them are are really interesting. They're really entertaining. they are not so like, they play a lot with the idea of dreams, on how through dreams the characters get to question certain aspects of modernity and their new lives in the cities. So on how, like, it's all again like this idea of like how they want to have a little bit of Europe, of European behaviors, European fashions and ways of living, and not really getting it, of course, but end up discovering actually how all communities used to live. So, for example, in Los Tejedores de la Noche, it's about a guy who's moves to the city from the mountains to La Paz, and then he's living in an apartment, and he hears that in the floor upstairs, like, there are machines, there are people doing knitting, and this is a real thing that happened to the author. Tur Sagasi is like, he was in the city and he was listening to these people who were working on their knits, and they sell that in the markets to tourists. So he starts to imagine these characters, like, us, who are these characters? He never seen them, and this, that's in the novel. He never gets to see them until the very end. And he said, like, he sees this as a metaphor of like these populations that are invisible, that you never see, but you know that they are working in the knits. You know that they are working in I don't know, they are plumbers, they are bread, they work in pastisseries, they work in, I don't know, like in the land, they work with their hands, and nobody really pays attention to them when they are the ones that really make up the country and move it forward, right? It's like, we never pay attention to the work of plumbers, something like that. It's like, but we only notice their importance when we have a problem with our toilets, right? So the book is something like that. It explores like, oh, what are these weavers doing, and what are their works? How many are they? And it's all this dreamy vision. It's complicated to explain, but I think that the author it's using this idea of dream, because for him it's easier to explain it that way. Like it is a more emotional way to portray these Indian migrants, right? And he, as a migrant, how he sees that. I don't know, it's just a very poetic way to see it. And it's not just, how can I say this? It's like, it's not depressing completely about the reality of migrants, but it also presents it in a way that it's, I don't know, it gives you hope. And I think the idea, like, representing and talking about his dreams, it's what makes it interesting. And then there is this other book, which is Jardín de Nora by Blanca Whitaker, and she has this, it's, this book is crazy because you have two German, it's very different, it's the whole thing is an allegory of migration, and, well, not migration, but more than colonization, right? Because colonization is also a migration process, and he puts it like that by and underscores how the people who came, the colonizers, the white populations in Bolivia want to leave like Europeans, and they come from Germany, and they want to build these beautiful gardens, reproduce these beautiful gardens that they have in Europe, and they can't in Bolivia because simply the land is rocky, and you're not going to have a lot of roses in a rocky terrain. And that's exactly what they try to do. And they go against the recommendations given by, people from the community. So then they say, like, do not grow plants here because the land is not the right land. It can create holes and it's going to crack. You cannot be here, basically. And they still do it because they want to have their European view of a garden, and instead of adapting to the what they can really grow in Bolivia. So then, like, their garden becomes like it cracks and creates holes, and this couple also have like children who become mute after a while. But towards the end, like this couple just hide them in the back of the house, and the kids only learn some Aymara words because they hear that from the gardener. The only thing they can speak, it's not German, is Aymara. And when they really utter words, they start yelling things in Aymara, and the earth keeps cracking, and they bore the parents. And it's like a whole metaphor of like the children who were born in Bolivia, who speak Aymara, who were sent to the back of the garden, the son of these migrants, migrants themselves, like they create like a vacuum, a hole in society that cannot, that represent this division between white populations and indigenous populations, of course. But it's also like these kids at the same time, and this is very interesting, they have their own garden, and this garden flowers with plants that are original from Bolivia, not flowers or plants brought from Europe. And so their story is different. It's a different rebirth in a way. But they have to create these, what I see as epistemological holes, these spaces that cannot be filled, these spaces that cannot be cannot create union, cannot create bridges in a way. Silvia Rivera Cusicanqui talks about this in a completely different way. It's obviously, like she said, like Bolivian society is like a combination of white and, let's say, white and black colors, where instead of having gray areas, you just see the whites, white and black points sewed together, that you think it's the same color, but in reality are the colors that have never merged together. And it's like, it's a society that it's pluricultural, pluriracial. Very different people live together next to each other, but they never really get to, I don't know, it's division and togetherness at the same time. And I think the book represents that in that precise way. Like it's like there's a hole between certain groups in society, and it's interesting because he's a migrant, and the author is the daughter of German migrants in Bolivia too, so she's criticizing her own kind in many ways. So yeah, this is what I saw in this book. And then Carmona's blog, there's a set of like different stories. They're all about a moment of change in Bolivia, like with Evo Morales, and how people are seeing that, and how now people who more white mestizos are scared of the Chola Paseña, which is this represents in the book this powerful economic power. Right, the same with Piñera's book, and I don't want to just summarize again the book, but it's a celebration of traditions of the Aymara traditions and festivity that it's like both books deal with El Gran Poder, which is like a big fiesta in Bolivia. It's a syncretic festivity, right? Because it's about Jesus with three faces, and they have these big dances, and they have like for a week competitions and yeah, celebration of this Christ. And but they are in both cases, in both works, the characters are awaiting for the awakening of this Andean entity. Something like the Incari, the return of the Incari, the return of the Inca, of the Pachacutec, and that's what they symbolize. And it's really interesting because in all this, actually in all the novels, there is an idea, a sense of return, and how like the going back to the town, the reverse migration, is going to lead to a rediscovery of the culture. And this rediscovery, it's like basically reproducing a political ideology of return where the indigenous populations are going to retake power and reorganize society. And that is what in so many different ways was happening with before Evo Morales, or what that led to his election and the aftermath. So it's a complete like a social revolution with indigenous peoples are recognized, and all this is in these novels. And it is very interesting because in the novels, you can see that political path. That is the background of these novels. And I think it's probably the most important thing. And I'm just mentioning it towards the end. But that's why these novels are so important.
Yeah, that's very interesting and very insightful of where you can find it in chapter 4 of your book. To wrap this interview up, this is a question I like to ask all my interviewees. And I'm very interested in hearing what you have to say on this aspect. But how do you think your book speaks to the present state of both Peruvian and Bolivian societies?
Well, it was published last year, and but I was working on it like for 3 years, I think. I think it actually talks about what's happening now, still in Peru. We have seen with COVID, for example, the reverse migration processes, and how people have like didn't even want these migrants in the passing by their communities in Lima, just because they needed to go back because they didn't have more economic resources to stay in the capital by themselves, right? And we have seen with COVID, for example, these all like very brutal like views of migrant populations in from the Andes and from the Amazonian region. So I think that that is a problem that is reflected in films and novels in Peru that have been represented before and then that's still being represented. And I think the problematic views of our society are still there, especially in Peru. In Peru, I think we are still a very colonial place. And in the case of Bolivia, we can see still the struggles towards recognizing indigenous populations. They have changed the constitution. They have declared officially a plural nation. They have indigenous people in power. And I mean, we had for a little bit Jeanine Áñez, who was trying to undo all the things that Evo Morales did, and to basically, like, I don't know, they had all these weird cleansing of even their own Congress. Like, they set fire here and there. They were insulting people for being Andean and for even trying to revalue their culture. And then this was the interim government. And then when they had their elections and they have Luis Arce again, like, it's not like he's Evo Morales, but... And I'm also not trying to idolize Morales, but he is like a milestone in the political ideology in Bolivia, right? He obviously has been in power, was in power for too long, but now they're trying to like recover and keep the changes or some of the changes they wanted. And so I think the book keeps talking about these current processes of political change and of pejorative views on migrants that we tend to veil most of the time.
Yes, definitely. And we have talked a lot about the book in depth, but is there anything you think we've missed or that you think we should mention that listeners should know about the book?
I don't know. Like we really, I think, mentioned a lot of things about it. I think that it is really, I think, something that it's important and that when I was researching for this book is that I haven't seen much comparative work between Bolivia and Peru when we are so close and so similar and dissimilar at the same time. And I think it's worth getting to know more about our neighbors, like not only Bolivian cultural productions, but also Ecuadorian, right, and Colombian, and see how their different visions of their traditional cultures inform their views on modernity and their takes on political reforms. I think that I think we're lagging behind in terms of like giving more power to indigenous communities or migrant communities in Lima. No, now like everybody thinks people don't even want to recognize themselves as migrant, even when they are second or third generation of migrants. And that is something that is very sad. And we have to ask, why is that so bad? What is the positive thing about having people coming or going back to their places of origin? How can we change that if it's something that it's really so bad as we tend to perceive it? So I think that the book questions that, and the book brings up like alternative ways to see migration, not just as crisis, not just as like it shows all the works. I think as a whole show the migrants as subjects who are very resourceful, that they can create alternative ways of living, alternative ways of thinking, alternative ways of relating to different people in the community and to create their own communities too. So I think we tend to forget that part. And that is, I think, something we need to pay attention to, right? And that's why I wrote the book, and I wrote it in comparison to Bolivia, because that would make us see it in a different way too. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I think we should definitely look to our neighbors more. Before we finish, is there any new projects you're working on right now you want to tell us about?
well, right now I'm doing research about like the influence of Chinese immigrants in the end and the end countries. And I'm starting with Peru. I'm actually also have a Chinese family, but I'm going to be exploring how racial solidarity help these Asian communities to become to acquire some not only affective capital because they became family, but also real economic capital to move forward in society. So that is part of my research. So I'm going to be doing that and exploring the political influence of these communities. It's so I think Peru is like many other countries, like it's a country of migrants, right? Like in the entire Andean region can be seen as a border. And that I'm interested in exploring all these different aspects to see what have we missed in the constitution of our people in Peru.
That sounds very interesting, and we're all looking forward to it. Thanks, Lorena, again for joining us here on the New Books Network in Latin American Studies to talk about your recent published book, Fictions of Migration, Narratives of Displacement in Peru and Bolivia.
Thanks to you, Kenneth.
Thank you again, and that's all from us here. Have a good day.